morning. Nomthando Skaka. I'm the committee secretary.
You go down here, please.
Good morning. My name is Bongiseni Ngcobo. I'm a committee researcher.
Energy Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, my name is Krizal Lewis. I'm Secretary to the World.
Morning, Rose Sonto, member of the committee.
Morning, my name is Nompula Freedom Asimini, member of the Energy Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, Eric Marie from the Mineral Resources Committee.
Faith Bikani, a member of the committee. Molweni, Kamalam Dimlomakayam Dak. Dipumapa, Glam Sabose, Eastern Cape. Engob, Dimamkwati is Duk. Engos in the Great Committee.
Can we hear from you on the other side, please? The gentleman with the brown suit through there.
Good morning. My name is Edmund Umalo, who's working for the Mining Qualifications Authority.
Good morning. My name is Pilot Gwe. I'm the committee secretary for Portfolio Committee on Energy.
Good morning. I'm Liz Webb, chairperson secretary.
Good morning. I'm Gillian, journalist.
Hello, Linda Ensel, Business Day.
Good morning. My name is Yunus Omar. I'm from the MQA.
Morning. My name is Amon Dedem. I'm representing the MQA. Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Darian Barkley. I'm from the Mining Qualifications Authority.
Good morning. My name is Sam Sipe from MQA.
Good morning. I'm Jay Moodley, also from the Mining Qualifications Authority.
Donnie de Villiers, consultant to CESL.
Good morning. My name is Thabo Ngwenya from the Mine Health and Safety Inspectorate.
Good morning. My name is Dipali Samukovoto from DMR.
Morning. My name is David Nsiza from the DMR.
Good morning. I'm Joseph Katenga from the DMR.
Good morning. My name is Jacinto Rocha, chairperson of the Petroleum Agency.
Good morning, I'm Stephen
Mills,
I'm
also from Petroleum Agency.
Good morning, I'm Linda Mekwe from the Regulation Division within the Petroleum Agency.
Good morning, I'm Olivia Munt, I'm the CFO at the Petroleum Agency.
Good morning, I'm Zeke van Averbeke from the Promotion Division of the Petroleum Agency.
Good morning, Ntoza Mitiku, the Chief Executive Officer of Petroleum Agency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We were joined whilst we were doing the round of introduction by Honorable Advocate Schmidt and also Mr. Donald from Business Report. You're also welcome. We've got quite a longish day. Because there's quite a lot of work that we must complete today. So we will be a bit strict on time and try to stick to the points and the relevant issues on the table. We're going to start with PASA, where they will take us through the outstanding matters. Very good of them because they've given us some of the documentation that reflects on some of those outstanding matters. And we would follow with the Mine Health and Safety Inspectorate to give us their annual report, followed by the MQA to also give us their annual report, after which we have to adopt all the reports of the state-owned entities that we dealt with. And from there, we would also adopt a report on the Northern Cape oversight visit. It's quite a full program in terms of the day. We will go beyond most probably lunchtime, but we will try and manage. So my appeal is that I know that some of the presenters are passionate with the work that they're doing. I'm not referring to you, madam. I know that even because of your passion, the media has simply shifted the spotlight squarely on you, which is good because it demonstrates the depth that is there in PASA in terms of the work that you're doing. So so that you take us through the salient points and starting with all those outstanding issues that we could not complete last time, and if there are any other new matters that would arise, we would then open the opportunity. Firstly, let's hear, are there any apologies to this meeting today?
There are no apologies.
I just bumped on the whip, Honorable Charlie, who indicated that there's something urgent that has arisen this morning. So he would likely join us later during the proceedings. Thank you very much. Shall we, without further ado, hand over to you, PASA? I think the CEO will then give us the direction.
Thank you, Chairperson. PASA's presentation is divided into two parts. One will deal with regulatory issues, and the other one will deal with shale gas. And the reason why we have split the presentation in these two parts is because, having analyzed the questions, we realized that there is a lot about the regulatory process that we had to clarify. And in the presentation on shale gas, we may have to repeat what we said last time, because also having analyzed the questions, we realize that we may have not been clear in what we presented. So there is going to be some repetition. But we're taking it in the context of this being an information session for the portfolio committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, for the opportunity afforded to us to present to you the regulatory framework around the Upstream Petroleum Agency. Honourable Chairs and Honourable Members, this particular slide actually focuses on, over and above the legislative framework that we have, as to what actually drives the Regulation Division in ensuring that there is compliance on the legislatory provisions and then also the internal processes that we employ in ensuring that we meet our deliverables. And the other thing that is actually also highlighted here is that the skill development within the Regulation Division is an ongoing thing, which we actually focus on developing personnel in order to ensure that we meet our customer perspective in relation to delivering what we are supposed to deliver in terms of what they expect from us. The next slide actually focuses on what actually is the provision of the Petroleum Agency in relation to...
Sorry, madam. Do we have a copy of your presentation in our possession? Second one. Which one? Is it contained in this? Is it contained in this? In this one? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Please continue.
Last, we wanted to see the copy that we're carrying.
They say it's contained in this one, which is written shade.
The processing of applications for upstream petroleum licensing actually comes from the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, which was actually promulgated in 2002. And in that particular legislation, it actually provides how the applications are supposed to be evaluated in terms of their legal fulfillment of the requirements, and then we also look into the technical aspects of the ability of the applicant, and then we also focus on the financial ability and the environmental requirements that the applicant must actually fulfill in relation to the respective application that he or the company seeks to achieve at the end of the day. So in that particular process, what I'd like to emphasize is that the legal requirements pertaining to those applications, we actually take into consideration the rules of laws that are actually applicable in South Africa, which actually goes as far as the property laws, and then also goes far as the company laws and all that. They actually play an important role in relation to ensuring that the particular applicants meet the legal requirements. And the technical ability actually focuses on what the applicant has in relation to him being able to perform the respective technology, and also the technical expertise in ensuring that whatever permits or rights that they apply for, they actually make it a point that they will fulfill those. They are in a position to make sure that they ensure that they've got the technical expertise to conduct those renaissance operations, technical corporations, and exploration and production and so on. The second phase, after the rights has been granted to the applicant, as soon as they have fulfilled the legal, financial, and the technical and environmental requirements, we as the petroleum agency ensures that all the laws that are applicable to that particular right that has been issued to them, the text, the terms and conditions of the particular rights are adhered to at all times. And we do that by making sure that we actually request the applicant, the holders of the right, to ensure that they provide us with a progress report or quarterly report pertaining to what they have actually indicated during the time when they were applying for an exploration right or production right, as the case may be. So in relation to the content of the right, we ensure that all the terms and conditions that are within the permits and rights are actually adhered to at all times. And we furthermore do an inspection whereby we actually conduct a site inspection over those operations to ensure that whatever terms and conditions have been complied for. And in relation to environmental management, what we do in assessing the environmental requirements and management as it will appear on the EMPR, we make sure that all the necessary tools and all the necessary inspections or whatever evaluation of the environment, the impact assessment have been done in order to ensure that the environmental requirements are adhered to. And in relation to evaluating the environmental management program that have been submitted by the applicant, during the time of the application, we make sure that we consult with the Department of Water Affairs to ensure that they also, in their administrative system, ensure that the content of the EMPR as the environmental management program has been submitted by the applicant actually fulfills the requirements of the National Environmental Act, and then also the Integrated Coastal Management Act, or any other legislation that will actually affect the environment in relation to the particular application that they seek to achieve at the end of the day. And then in response to the question that was actually raised by Honorable Smith in relation to sourcing out seawater in a case whereby there's a water distress, there is an Integrated Coastal Management Act that actually provides for how the applicant needs to fulfill those requirements in order to ensure that there are legal authority pertaining to an applicant to source out water from the sea, and then that also affects the Department of Water Affairs in ensuring that all the necessary requirements pertaining to sourcing out water from the sea are actually adhered to. The other part that we look into in relation to evaluating the application that we receive in respect of the permits and rights that the minister issues at the end of the day is to make sure that the water source, the water use, and the wastewater management by the applicant, because of what normally happens is that the applicant in the environmental management program that he has or she has to, or the company has to submit in support of the application, they need to make sure that they indicate in the environmental management program to us to ensure that where they will actually be sourcing out water that they will use in relation to their operation, and then how they will actually manage the wastewater that comes as a result of whatever activity that they wish to conduct. So in relation to that, we also look into the National Water Act in relation to whatever waste or whatever contamination that will occur as a result of this operation to water, and we make sure that we emphasize the point that on the environmental management program, the applicant has to ensure and has to make sure that he indicates or they indicate this particular way of indicating to us as to how they are actually going to treat the waste that comes with whatever operation that is generated by the operation, and where are they going to source the water, and how they are going to transport that water to their facilities. So we make sure that the National Water Act is adhered to, but in the evaluation process of that particular EMPR, we make sure that we consult the Department of Water Affairs to make sure that they comment on the document that have been submitted to them in relation to a specific application that have been submitted. And the other legislation that we look into is the Mine Health and Safety Act. Under the Mine Health and Safety Act, what we require is what the Act provides is that the applicant has to indicate how he is or they are going to protect the health and safety of the employees, and then and how are they going to make sure that the requirements pertaining to the protection of health and safety are going to be administered. In this particular legislation, we make sure that all the necessary provision and then the measures that must be in included in the application process are supposed to be contained in the application documents and the supporting document in relation to describe or to explain as to how they will ensure that protection and health and safety of the employees are going to be handled. So the other legislation that we also contribute in ensuring that there is a streamlined process of registration is the Mining Title Registration Amendment Act. So basically this legislation, in terms of the process of it, comes after the right has been granted. So once the right has been granted, and the right will only be granted as soon as the applicant has actually fulfilled all the requirements pertaining to the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act and also the legislation that I've already mentioned. So we make it a point that all the legislation that is that regulates the Upstream Petroleum Agency, the requirements of it are met in order for the right for the minister to be granted. So basically the recommendation that goes to the minister contains how the applicant has said in relation to making sure that he meets or they meet the fulfillment of the requirements. So basically, many types of registration act will only come in after the right has been granted, and this particular legislation actually focuses on the registration part of that particular right. Another issue that the Honorable Chair has also raised was to present the compliance report pertaining to the broad-based socioeconomic empowerment charter by the holders of the rights that we have been issued. So far, we have issued a production right to PetroSA, and then they have provided us with the social and labor plan, which was actually approved during the time that they were before before the approval of that particular rise. And then in their undertaking, they actually committed to do 6 infrastructure development programs and then also 5 poverty alleviation projects, which are actually mentioning from, it's just a summary of what they indicated in the social and labor plan. But the focus is merely on the infrastructure development and poverty alleviation. So out of the 6 infrastructure development that they have committed to do in relation to fulfilling the terms and conditions of the production right, they have managed so far, because they were given this particular right in 2007. So they have managed so far to complete 2 infrastructure development projects, of which 4 of their projects are still in progress. They have not been completed. And then they are doing that in consultation with the Mossel Bay municipalities, and then they also have managed to do 2 of 5 poverty alleviation projects, and then the 3 other projects, they are still in the process of completing it before the financial year 2012. So as one of the mechanism that we use in ensuring that the risk compliance with the broad-based socioeconomic empowerment charter, what we normally do is that we make sure that we assess the progress report from the operators on the social and labor plan, which they submit twice in a year, because of most of the project actually covers for 6 months or a year. And then we make a site inspection to verify the credibility of those progress report. And then as soon as we have done that, we come up with a compliance report to ensure that what they have committed to do, they have actually done it. And in a case whereby there was actually non-compliance with the undertakings that they have committed to do, we make it a point that we issue directive for compliance. And Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, that's basically the overview.
Thank you very much. I think in order for us to speed up the process, Honourable Members, let's handle each presentation, have those brief questions, and move on. Are there any questions for this section of the presentation, which is to do with the regulatory? yes, Cecil?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Chairperson, we've got 2 presentations for regulation. I was just wondering if we shouldn't complete that and then we'll take questions for all regulatory matters.
No, because I thought this was the only one. No, please do.
Chairperson, for the sake of time, while Mr. Steve Mills is setting up, I would also just like to touch on 2 questions that were raised, I think mainly by Honourable Hrailing and Morgan, on the licensing round and the moratorium. The question on the licensing round was, why was there necessity for a licensing round, for licensing rounds, and why a moratorium? The applications and licensing process for petroleum exploration throughout the world is conducted through one or both of the following methods, which in South Africa are provided for in Section 73 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, Section 73. The first subsection provides that the minister may, by notice in the Government Gazette, invite applications for exploration and production rights in respect of any block or blocks, and may specify in such notice the period within which any application may be lodged with the designated agency and the terms and conditions subject to which such rights may be granted. The second subsection provides that the designated agency may otherwise directly receive applications for exploration and production rights in respect of such blocks which are not subject to an invitation as contemplated in subsection 1. So the licensing round is as such invitation for applications as provided for in Section 71. As I did say, where the general practice has been an open door or first come first served method, it then becomes necessary in order to have an orderly applications process to preserve the acreage. Now, the preservation of the acreage for the applications process is done in the form of the moratorium. So, and that is done in order to have appropriate governance for the area, and this would be for cases where there has been a lot of interest in a particular area. So in order to regulate that, in order to govern that area properly, then you put it out on a licensing round. So licensing round per se does not mean that you are necessarily licensing, as perhaps the term might suggest. What it means is that it's applications as per specific invitation by the minister in terms of Section 73. And then just quickly, there was another question that was raised, that there seems to be a bias towards the procedure, that the agency has already taken a position with regard to the exploration. The primary criteria for the assessment of an application are technical capacity, financial resources, lodgement of financial guarantee equivalent to the expected environmental damage, and the ability to preserve the integrity of the environment and rehabilitate where there is resultant degradation. Techniques and procedures used are viewed not as independent variables, but in the context of the assessment criteria already mentioned. The agency has not taken any position on the various applications received in the Southern Central Karoo Basin. The assessment procedure is as explained by the General Manager regulation. The agency does not view the development, environment, management discourse as one necessitating choosing between the two extremes. We are guided by Section 2H of the MPRDA, which read with Section 24 of the Constitution of the country, and joins us to ensure that the nation's mineral and petroleum resources are developed in an orderly and ecologically sustainable manner while promoting justifiable social and economic development. So what we're saying is it is our responsibility to ensure that the correct balance is struck between the two. It's not an either-or situation. It's not a development versus environmental management situation. And this is provided for in the Constitution and in Section 2H of the MPRDA. Mr. Steve Mills, next to me, is from the Regulator Division, and he will put the proper context to the technical issues relating to exploration and production methods. Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Twepo, because this matter that you've just reported on was discussed prominently last time, are there any time frames that you have set yourselves in terms of processing this application? Not to say that we want you to be in a rush. I mean, last time you made it quite clear that you would want to process it through the set guidelines and procedures as well as the legal requirements. But just for us to have a sense in terms of going forward, this is a matter that is of national importance. Are we expecting it sometime within 2011, or expecting your responses sometime in 2012? Or for that matter, have the applicants fulfilled the requirements, the initial requirements in terms of submitting an application?
Thank you, Chairperson. I will assume that this application refers to the Shell application. And just to put it in context, Shell are not the only applicants in this area. There are other applicants. There is Sungu Sungu, there is Bundu Gas, there is Falcon Oil. So there are other applications. This one just happens to have the prominence that it has gained. The time frames are as provided for in the legislation. when they submit an application, we must respond within 14 days, which is what we did in December of 2010, in terms of whether there is any prior application or any existing right within the area of application. Now, that phase then is the acceptance phase. It's just the acceptance of the application as it is presented and for its completeness. It is not an acceptance with respect to the merits of the application or the applicant. The acceptance goes with an instruction to the applicant which says you have 120 days within which you must come back and give to us your plan of how you are going to deal with the environment, which is called the Environmental Management Plan. Now, if you can't count 120 days from December, you will get to the middle of April. And on or before the 14th of April, Shell must present to us their Environmental Management Program, which we also have a period of 120 days to assess, raise all the questions that we have, put to them the issues that were raised. If they have not covered those issues in their environmental management plan and ensure that those have been answered. If we are not comfortable that they have not been answered, the application may not proceed from that stage. It may be rejected. The time 120 days will take us towards the end of the year to about, September, thereabout, at which point we will then, if they have answered the basic questions, we will make our recommendations to the minister being the Minister of Mineral Resources, to make the decision on the application. And therefore, Chairperson, yes, it is possible that within 2011, towards the end of the year, if the application is approved, it could be granted at that stage, and if not, then it will not be. And this will apply to the other applicants as well who applied at different times. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. You may proceed, sir.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Thank you for this opportunity to address you. I understand that we are somewhat pressed for time, so I'll head on. As explained already, I'm within the regulation division and my job title is technical compliance manager, so I'm heavily involved in evaluating the technical aspects of applications. Amongst the questions that were posed last week was one regarding policy with relation to hydraulic fracturing. I'm not going to answer that directly, but give you a broader overview of the exploration process. And so we'll start here. Like any good explorer, if you were going to another country, you wouldn't just get on an aeroplane and go there and then try and figure out, well, where am I, what am I going to do? You do some reading up, you'll get the Lonely Planet guidebook. Well, this is exactly what the explorers do. They do their desktop studies at home, and they will read up all the present literature and so on. From there, they will consider, well, maybe we need to know some more about this country and may proceed to remote sensing. And from there to low-impact surface techniques through seismic surveys and ultimately to the acid test of any exploration operation, which is to drill a well. This is the only way to find out whether there is actually oil and gas in the ground. Assuming the project is successful, it will then move through to production. And after 10 or 20 or 30 years of production, we go into the abandonment phase. And each of these phases has its own methodologies. And hydraulic fracturing is just one of the methodologies within this whole package, and I will point out when we get to that point. Okay, so for the desktop studies, as already mentioned, they will almost certainly start by consulting a geological map, because obviously if you're looking for oil and gas, there's no point in, well, it may not be obvious, but you wouldn't go to an area like the Bushveld Igneous Complex. There's no chance of there being oil or gas there. So you can begin to focus your activities immediately. You will consult data repositories, such as the agency. We have a very strong information services department whose sole function is to collect and archive and redeliver to new explorers all reports and information about oil and gas exploration in the Republic. Similarly, the Council for Geoscience holds quite a lot of very useful information. There's also a lot of published literature in the form of academic studies. And it might also be helpful to consult the previous holders of rights because they don't always give all their information to everybody. But if you ask nicely, sometimes they'll let you have it. And ultimately, this allows the explorers to build a picture of the surface geology of the area and from there begin to project an understanding of the subsurface geology, where the different layers of rock go to underground. And that process is the start of a process called basin modeling. So that's desktop studies. Then, assuming they've found in their desktop studies some area to be reasonably interesting, they might proceed to remote sensing, and this can involve looking at satellite imagery. You may be familiar with spot images with false color and all kinds of strange, weird-looking images of the Earth. Aerial photography is also quite useful. You can see fracture lineaments. And they may also commission new work in the form of aerial gravity or magnetic surveys. And these begin to build the picture of what's going on below the surface. After remote sensing, again, we get slightly more involved in the surface. They may decide that it would be useful to go and visit the surface and examine the rocks at where they outcrop at the surface to get an idea of what rocks they're dealing with and how they might change underground. They may do soil gas sampling because this can be an indicator of whether there is oil and gas further down in the ground. And they may conduct magnetotelluric surveys. This is a mechanism for measuring magnetic currents or the changes of magnetic currents in the near surface. Again, beginning to build this picture of what's going on underground. This is an image from, this is a satellite image. You'll see from the logo in the lower right-hand corner. This is freely accessible from Google. And with a little imagination, you can see where the various rock bands are going and that they're running more or less east-west. And you could begin to build an understanding of the subsurface geology from this. And this is the really high-tech activity of examining surface outcrops and taking samples. From there, it would normally proceed through seismic surveys, and these come in various phases, different levels of detail. Two-dimensional, you simply get a limit, like a piece of wallpaper, just a picture of a section, a line through the Earth. The next phase, in more detail, assuming that the two-dimensional survey is positive, will give you a block of, a volume, they call it, of information. And when you get to the production phase, you may decide to install the sensors permanently and repeat these measurements over time, and which gives us a fourth dimension. The basic processing of seismic sections will allow us to see the subsurface structure where the different layers of rock. And it's also possible to extract from this data with a hugely intensive computational efforts, different attributes for the various layers of rock, which begin to indicate the possibility of whether there's oil or gas present at a particular level in the Earth. This is a seismic survey vessel. Most of my images will relate to the offshore, which is where most of the activity has taken place so far. In the onshore, we're still at the very early stages. You will understand that Shell hasn't got its rights yet, so it hasn't been able to conduct any operations for us to take pictures of. So again, most of our images are for the offshore. This is a seismic survey vessel. You can begin to get an impression of the scale of this operation. This vessel will be towing, it's quite a substantial vessel itself, and it will be towing cables 5 or 6 kilometers long, and there will not be one, but 10 running parallel over at about 100 meters separation. And it has a large drum, and the cables contain microphones, and the microphone records are sampled 500 times a second. So if you've got 150 microphones in your cable, you've got 10 cables, and you're sampling 500 times a second, you begin to realize that the volumes of data involved here are very significant. The next image is of a vessel, which is in operation today. Petro SA has commissioned this vessel to conduct a survey in Block 9. Very sleek and new-looking vessel, I must say. Again, the next phase after seismic surveys, hallelujah, we're going to drill a hole and discover whether our gamble has been successful. Because that's what we're talking about here. The exploration is a hugely risky endeavor, and all of the work that's gone before builds progressively to try and reduce the risk of failure. And in drilling a well, the operators must decide first whether to drill a vertical well, which is the simplest and easiest to deal with, or whether to drill an inclined well and maximize the contact with the potential reservoir, whether to drill a single well or to try and drill several wells from one well pad, as you'll hear more about later, or whether to drill a single vertical core and then drill several horizontal laterals extensions, all from the same place. Technical considerations include the type of mud to be used as the drilling fluid, where to set the casing points, whether or not to involve a blowout preventer, and what to do with the cuttings. Environmental issues will receive more attention later, I'm sure, in discussion. During the drilling process, there will be a geologist, ordinarily, there will be a geologist on site looking at the rocks as the chips are brought back to the surface and deciding whether to cut cores. Coring is invaluable because it provides a solid sample of the rock for detailed examination, including x-rays and photographs and organic carbon analysis. Once the drilling is completed, the well will normally be subject to geophysical logging, where a series of electrical tools are run down to the end of the well, and this may be as much as 5,000 or 6,000 meters. The electrical tools are run down to the bottom, and then measurements of electrical resistivity, gamma ray activity, rock density, and so on, are measured continuously at intervals of typically 10 centimeters. So if you're logging, again, if you're logging a 1,000-meter section at 10-centimeter intervals with 15 or 20 parameters, the data volumes become significant. And finally, if the well has been successful, it may be desirable to test or confirm your interpretation that there is oil or gas here and encourage it to flow to the surface. This is a process simply called testing in the oil field industry, or drill stem testing. And if that's successful, or if it's marginally successful, it may be decided to do flow stimulation, and this is where hydraulic fracturing comes in. Hydraulic fracturing is just one possible mechanism for flow stimulation. The idea is to improve the flow of oil or gas out of the rock into the wellbore. I know that the focus of current attention in the media is Shell's applications in the Southern Karoo, and particularly the fear that hydraulic fracturing may have some deleterious effects. Hydraulic fracturing is not unique to shale gas exploration. It's used broadly across the industry in a variety of different operations. Also, it has even been used in South Africa previously in coalbed methane exploration and offshore by Petro SA as much as 20 years ago. Hydraulic fracturing as a technology has been around for 50 or 60 years, so it's well developed, relatively mature. The new aspect has been being able to perform several fracturing operations consecutively in a single borehole. So that's drilling and flow simulation. My images are a little bit out of sequence here. This is a two-dimensional seismic section, and it shows you this is the first stage of processing of seismic data. And you can see immediately some indication of the orientation of the different rock layers. This is an image of a similar data where the processing has been used to highlight a particular attribute of the rock, which may be indicative of the presence of oil or gas. This, fortunately, we have some onshore images. This is from the Free State, circa 1975. These kinds of rigs are commonly used for drilling wells down to 500 or 700 meters. This is a compressed air rig and typically produces just chips of rock, but not core. This is a larger rig in Australia. This was drilling a horizontal well through a coal layer continuously as an element of a CBM operation. But the same technology would be used in shale gas exploration. Same rig, and this is an offshore one. This is drill stem testing where the gas and oil are coming to the surface, and rather than just dumping them into the sea or venting them into the atmosphere, they are burnt to reduce their greenhouse gas effect. that production, from that test, it will be seen that the operator thought there was something potentially commercial here. The next phase is production. Production uses essentially the same technologies, just uses them more intensively over a small area. And again, we'll use technologies to include, to enhance oil recovery if oil is the form of hydrocarbon present. And again, that might involve hydrocarbon, hydraulic fracturing or acid stimulation or other forms of flow enhancement. And eventually we get to abandonment, let's say 10 or 20 or 30 years' time. The requirements for abandonment are likely to be quite different because onshore we understand that it would be highly desirable to remove all of the surface equipment. The well must be sealed in any event to prevent the escape of hydrocarbons into the environment, and that's typically accomplished by setting two cement plugs in the well, one near the bottom, to prevent the hydrocarbons getting into different layers of rock where they're not present normally, and one near the top to present as a further safety measure and to prevent extraneous material getting into the hull. But the rest, the wellhead and surface equipment would normally be removed. Offshore, that may not be so, because there's a growing feeling or movement that the shall we call them, sterile areas that such installations on the seafloor create from a fishing perspective provide safe havens or breeding grounds for target fisheries. So it's not, may not be necessary to remove all the equipment. But at all times, these operations are to be conducted with the utmost regard for safety of humans and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As we have indicated, honorable members, let's then pose our questions to both presentations. I note Honorable Matibela, Honorable Schmidt. That's it for now. Honorable Sonto, Honorable Khululu, Honorable Mdaka. All right.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the wonderful presentation. My question is on the chances of South Africa to have oil and not relying on other countries. Is there any chance of us as South Africans to have that? The other one is the acid testing. Does that mean in the old mines were not covered so that they can stop bringing the acid outside? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chick. I just want to put the whole, see whether I understand the whole Shell issue, because you're saying there are a multiplicity of applicants. Were these applications all submitted in reasonably the same time period? And are the other applicants also basing their, at least on the acceptance of their application, on the fracking method in terms of, if I understand it, it's a method of flow stimulation. So in the application, did the other companies also use fracking as a flow stimulation method? And could it be conceivably be so that they could say, well, I'm not in favor of fracking, but a different method of flow stimulation, and the application still be approved or rejected? So in other words, to put it in a nutshell, there's other ways in which the Shell application, for instance, or the other application could be approved or rejected based on a different flow stimulation. Am I summing it up correctly if I were someone in the street were to ask me? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sonto.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Mine is on the permits and rights, the monitoring mechanism that is applied there.
Can you pull your mic closer to you, please? Thank you.
To right holders.
field of mining, there's a lot of ducking and diving on this aspect by right holders. They would explore and explore and explore and explore without giving any reports about that exploration. And at the tail end of that exploration, they would say there's nothing. Yet the indication would be that a lot has been taken out of that exploration. Now, on that, has there been any transgressions experienced? And if there were, what were those transgressions? And what were the strictest measures meted out to those right holders that refused to comply? Because really in this field, there's a lot of non-compliance, deliberate non-compliance. And we suspect, therefore, that it is because either DMR or the regulator, I would say, is lacking in terms of applying stringent measures. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hululu, who you covered. Honorable Daga.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for both presentations. Mine will be from the presenter number one. On the last slide, I would like to know the two of the five poverty alleviation projects that has been completed, if you can name them, and the time frame of the three that is in progress. Chairperson, my apologies if you have already discussed this. It's just that I'm new in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would you care to respond to those?
Thank you, Chairperson. If I could start. We'll start with Honorable Matibela's questions. Chances of oil in South Africa. Chairperson, yes, we do have oil in South Africa and we do have gas in South Africa, and both are currently being produced in the South Coast. We do have a production right off the West Coast for the production of gas in the Ibubesi gas field, which has been proven to be commercially viable. At the moment, they are busy with a market development exercise. Further chances of oil and gas, it is difficult to say. There is a lot of speculation. You heard us talking about possibilities of 5 to 20 to however many TCF of gas. This is trillion cubic feet in the Karoo Basin. But all of those will be speculation. It's advised speculation by technical people, but the proof of any availability and quantity is always in the drilling and in the actual research and physical determination of the availability and quantity of petroleum. The old mines and acid main drainage. Chairperson, we have not in the petroleum field encountered this problem yet, and I'm very reluctant for us to respond because this is a matter that is being held, that is being attended to by a special committee, I think set up by cabinet up in the Transvaal, which is headed by, I think the chairperson is Dr. Ramucha. I would rather not venture into that at this stage. I will give over to Steve first for Mr. Smith's question.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I appear to have confused the issue by introducing the term acid test. You'll understand this is from the gold mining industry. Sorry about that. The applications all the applications for what we believe will essentially be shale gas exploration have been received over a period of 6 or 9 months. So it's a relatively short period, but not days, not weeks. They're not all at the same stage. Falcon is most advanced, it applied first. We are nearing a recommendation to the minister as to whether to or not to grant the exploration right. Shells will take somewhat longer. Sasol, you may be aware, also have applied for rights. We issued them with a technical cooperation permit in November last year, and they have a year to do their desktop studies, and that will then follow through the process. So it's going to be spread out over time. They will, for shale gas, all will depend on hydraulic fracturing. That is the technology that enables shale gas exploration and production. I think I'll stop there. There are not practically any alternatives for shale gas exploration. So if it is determined that hydraulic fracturing is unacceptable, then yes, Shell's application must fail. But we have not taken a position on this issue yet. Have I addressed all your questions?
Could I abuse the opportunity by asking the other applications, are they also for shale gas or are they for other forms of minerals?
There are several applications in the general area known as the Karoo. There are about 6 or 7. But they are 6 or 7 out of a total of 220 that we have received over since the implementation of the Act. So there are many, many more looking in different areas for instance, coal bed methane, some looking offshore. Honourable Suntu, I believe, your question about perennial exploration without reporting, most of our operators are completely up to date with their reporting and are generally, they play open cards with us and we have a positive relationship with them. Of course, this is not universally true. We have some who need to be reminded to report and some who, even when reminded, have not reported. And the heaviest sanction that is available to us is to recommend to the minister the cancellation of a right. We haven't yet reached that stage. You'll understand that that's a very severe action to take. We haven't yet reached that stage, but I can foresee that it might happen within the next 12 months.
In response to Honorable Mdaka's question in relation to two poverty alleviation projects by Petro SA, it was the stormwater paving that they did at Dukom's Access Road. What they did is that they employed the residents of the Dukom's to construct that particular pavement. Because of it had a problem, the road had a problem with the floods, and then nobody was actually able to even have to walk on that road because of the influx pertaining to the flood. And then what Petro SA did was to make sure that it employs the residents around the area to construct that particular pavement. And then another project that they did was an extension of the cleaning program, which was actually done in consultation with the municipalities, Nongaba project. And the remaining projects that are still pending is actually an extension of deforestation program in Freeman's Hay and an extension program in Great Park, and then also a small business development that they are going to construct at Kwan Nongaba. So those are the three outstanding projects that they have to do this financial year ending 2012.
If we may ask, given the period of existence of Petro SA, this project look a bit few. Is this by design? Is this all as a result of inability to afford? or what could be the problem?
In terms of the report that we got from them, Honorable Chair, I'm not sure as to is with regard to the design or their financial constraints, because each and every project has its own budget allocation, of which they have to make it a point that during that financial year they make it a point that they implement that particular commitment. As to whether they chose that project based on the design or the financial constraint, I'm not sure. It's what we normally encourage them to do is just to give us an indication of what is it that they will do in order to alleviate poverty. So we don't make it mandatory to them to, or specify to them which project they are supposed to do. They are the one that actually come up with the project in consultation with their municipalities.
All right, thank you very much. I think also there are some other couple of questions that just basically on the legislative framework. Are there any mechanisms for appeal, either by the applicants or by parties that are affected? Let's take the situation of the shale gas applications in the Karoo Basin. There are members of community, being farmers and so forth, that feel that this should not be approved. But do you have procedures that are built in so that there could be these appeals that could be processed in the event that there are those? But to you, sir, a very important subject for the Portfolio Committee on Mineral Resources, the seismic survey that you're conducting, if it is found that there's prevalence and there's likelihood of seismic events occurring in the process of the drilling of the gas, what do you do to that application? Do you abandon it, or do you recommend some other means to deal with it, particularly in terms of the early detection of the seismic event occurring? I mean, this is a question that we're dealing with the other agencies within the mining industry, because for us, it's the major contributing factor in terms of fatalities that we have in the mining industry. So any investigations that get conducted yielding results are most welcome on our part. But just to clarify on that, those would be the two follow-up questions, yes.
In relation to the appeal process, yes, the legislation provides for the appeal process for afforded to the applicant if ever the right was actually not granted to him, and so the law requires the applicant to appeal against the decision that was actually done in relation to his application. And then in relation to the interested and affected parties, landowners who have an issue around the application, yes, the law provides for that particular process to take place in the form of an objection. So they can launch an objection with the department or with PASA in relation to how they feel with the application that have been forwarded or accepted by petroleum agency. In that regard, yes, we do have those two processes in place that are for the two aggrieved parties.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my question is to get clarity on what has been explained. The procurement of rights, the exploration and drilling rights, I'm really trying to grapple with it. Is it through the tendering process, as we conventionally know, or is it a first come, first serve basis, or a combination of both? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chair, yeah, with regard to the seismic surveys, There's an unfortunate coincidence of terminology here. When we talk about seismic surveys in the petroleum industry, we're not talking about triggering seismic events such as would cause rockfalls in mines and so on. The full name of the term technology is seismic reflection surveying, and the idea is that the energy wave from the survey vessel mimics that of an energy wave resulting from a seismic event, an earthquake event, and it's really just a high-intensity pressure wave traveling through the rocks in the same way that the pressure waves from earthquakes travel through rocks. So it doesn't. We're not talking about triggering seismic events, which may have some damaging effect.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson Jigalana. On the question regarding the applications methods, whether it's first come, first served, or it's by bidding, the answer is it is both. Section 73 of the NPRDA provides for both. Now, the manner in which they are applied is that generally, especially with us that don't have an abundance of oil and gas resources, the general method is to allow for people to identify in the manner that Steve described any area that they feel their analysts tell them is potentially prospective. They will identify that and they will apply on a first-come, first-served basis. That is also called the open door system. Now, in the event that there is a huge interest in one particular area of the country, and also in the event that there has been an area that has been, let's say, under license, let's say there was a reconnaissance permit over it for a period of a year, and that is about to be either reduced or parts of it relinquished. As you can understand, if there are a lot of people interested, there would be a huge rush about, you know, I was here at 8:05 and the other one was. So in order to stop all of that and in order to have proper governance of the area, of any area of huge interest, you then go to Section 73(1) of the Act and reserve that area, putting out the specific parameters of it and say this area shall not be on an open door, first come, first served method, but shall be by invitations, in other words, the bids. And so the necessary notices are put out by the minister to say from the 1st of July to the 30th of September, this area is open for bids by all people interested, and the bids shall be for this type of license, and these are the requirements, that these are the criteria that we will be looking at. It will generally be the criteria that will be in the Act, but now this becomes competitive. In other words, it's not about who came at 5 to 8 and who came at 8:05. It's about the strength of the merits of the applicant in terms of their technical ability, financial ability, and the requirements, the criteria set out by our country. For example, the strength of involvement of the previously disadvantaged, all of those will be the criteria that they will be competing on. But it is not on a first-come, first-served basis. It's a competitive bid for a particular period of time set out in a government notice. So, yes, both methods are used, and generally the first-come, first-served will be used, but for specific reasons, the 73-1 method of license bids will be used. I hope that clarifies it, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Let's move on. I understand you have one last presentation to make.
Thank you. chairs, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for providing this opportunity for me to address you again. In our consideration of the questions that were raised, it was... Oh, sorry. Hold on a moment. I couldn't understand why this happened to other people. In our considerations of the questions that were raised in response to my last presentation, realized that perhaps I hadn't been completely clear. So what I'm going to do now is run through the general principles of shale gas, and this is based, information is based on our research. It's on interaction with international experts in various fields, and also attendance at a number of conferences, both locally and internationally, including the Global Shale Gas Initiative, which was hosted by the United States State Department. In the process, I hope that I will address the questions that were raised last week. Some of the slides and the information is repeated. I hope you allow me this latitude. And some of what I have to say has been dealt with in more detail by my colleagues, and I will go through those more quickly, and I will try to keep my enthusiasm under check. The topics that I wish to cover today will be briefly to look at shale gas to assist those who might not have been here last week. I'm going to focus a little bit on conventional versus unconventional. I think this is something that needs to be clear when considering these problems, considering shale gas and the issues. I will look very briefly at the exploration production methods used because Mr. Mills has covered that in a lot more detail. And then finally, look at the global experience of the benefits and the disadvantages or issues of this resource play. And I will end with a historical review. It says from the 1980s, but in my review I discover it's actually from the 1820s. I hope to keep it to a limited amount of time. So if I start briefly with the definitions of what is shale gas, as I mentioned before, it's simply a hydrocarbon gas that we get from a shale. A shale is a compressed rock made up of very fine-grained materials such as clay and silt with a low permeability. The problem with shales, or in fact with any low permeability reservoir, is that gas does not flow out of them easily. And to get the gas out of the shale requires special technology, and these have been recently, not recently developed, but actually recently optimized to make the processes economic. If we look at conventional versus unconventional, I think this is an interesting diagram. We could say generally that conventional resources are small volumes that are easy to develop. And we contrast that with unconventional resources, which are large volumes that are difficult to develop. If we look at this, we can think of conventional resources as being the tip of the pyramid, moving down through tight gas sands, which are actually conventional resources, but where the permeability of your reservoir is very low, to cold bed methane, which is an unconventional resource in the proper meaning of the word, in that it is in an unconventional reservoir, and it requires unconventional methods to produce it, to shale gas, which is and finally to gas hydrates. Conventional resources, tight gas sands, coal bed methane, have been produced successfully for a fair amount of time. Shale gas has now reached a time when it is in focus, the focus of explorers, and has been very successful in the United States. Gas hydrates, not a part of this discussion, but at the moment we can say it hasn't been vanquished by the explorers as yet. It's under review, but it still presents huge and technical and logistical problems. If we look at unconventional gas plays, which are onshore, that's excluding the gas hydrates, we can look at tight gas sands. These are conventional gas reservoirs, but in the fact that they have low permeability, they find in traditional and basin center settings, they require stimulation in order to get them to produce. Colbert Methane. We're also looking for this in South Africa. It's a self-sourcing reservoir. The reservoir, the coal, forms both the source and the reservoir for Colbert Methane. It requires depressuring and usually dewatering. These are both issues of concern for the use and the use of water and its disposal. Shale gas, or gas shale, it's referred to here, is a self-sourcing reservoir. The gas is absorbed into the organic matter, and it requires a fracture network, either natural or induced, in order to be exploited. If we look at the small diagram on the left, you can see the coal bed methane. It occurs in very shallow depths. It's associated with coal. It is of concern in that it relates at shallow depths to areas where aquifers might be present. Shale gas, on the other hand, is very deep. As mentioned before, it can be in the order of 2 to 6 kilometers, separated from your potable aquifers by a significant thickness of impermeable rock. You will have seen the slide before. I showed it last week, and I just wanted to recap on the process of conventional gas development. Gas is reservoired in the shale, the gray area at the bottom. This is expelled under pressure into the more porous and permeable sandstones, which are therefore at a lower pressure. The gas, being light, moves upwards until it reaches a place where it can no longer move further, such as a trap, indicated by the small red bump. I don't think I can have a pointer. I don't know which screen to point at. And there it is trapped as a conventional reservoir. It can also be trapped in tight sandstones within. If you excuse me, I will point behind you. It can also be trapped in sandstones that occur within this bed, but which are not permeable or porous, and therefore the gas cannot escape out of them. Shale gas is sourced by this same shale, this gray layer that you see at the base here. It does not escape because the permeability is very low. It is actually the gas that has not escaped into the sandstone. It's retained within the shale. And this is where, and if we look at these two, you can see that vertical drilling is associated with the production usually from conventional reservoirs because the gas is in a permeable reservoir. It moves from the reservoir into the well bore and back to the surface. And in the case of shale gas, you drill a vertical well. You then turn horizontally and drill through the shale in order to maximize your connection between the well bore and your prospective horizon. The gas is then, what you see here is a thing called a pumper truck. This is not a, I will deal with that later. The gas moves out of the shale and into the well bore and back to surface. It is not pumped. It moves under lithological pressure. The pressure of the lithology itself forces the shale into the lower pressure of the well bore. So therefore, it does not need to be pumped or sucked to the surface. I think that answers one of the questions that was raised last week. If we look at some of the exploration and production methods, I'm going to go through this very quickly because Mr. Mills has dealt with it in some detail. I'd like to point out a rather scary picture here. This is in Canada, in Alberta. This is a surface production method. This is the mining of oil shales at the surface. We do not have oil shales in South Africa, and we are unlikely to be subjected to this process. However, we do have subsurface indications of oil and gas, and we would use vertical drilling and horizontal drilling. Vertical drilling generally is for conventional reservoirs and horizontal for unconventional. Vertical drilling is likely to be used most predominantly during the exploration phase, because horizontal drilling together with hydraulic fracturing are expensive processes and are unlikely to be used unless there is evidence of a successful outcome. Or this is the general principle. Stimulation methods, we have chemical, various types of stimulation methods. There's chemical methods are such as matrix acidizing. This is to improve the permeability of a conventional reservoir. I'd like here for many years, and this is for decades, this has been used in the petroleum industry and in South Africa. The acids that are pumped down the conventional borehole are hydrochloric acid, hydrofluoric acid, acetic, formic, sulfamic, and chloroacetic acid. These are all injected into wells under highly controlled procedures and are regulated by best practice and the principles of not damaging the environment or human life. The other stimulation methods are mechanical. These are the ones we've heard more about. They can be fracturing or hydraulic fracturing. The hydraulic fracturing is merely a mechanical stimulation that is assisted by the addition of lubricant, and that is the frac fluid. If we look at the process of hydraulic fracturing, I'd like to address some of the questions that were raised last week during my brief description through this process. If we look at it in order as what happens, it will start by a well, a vertical well being drilled to a kickoff point at which the well would then be, the well would then be turned horizontal through the shale. That would then be set up ready for the process of hydraulic fracturing. Tanker trucks or some other process would be used to deliver water to the site. There would be a pumper truck, which would be the fracturing unit, which would be responsible for injecting the liquid and the water and the lubricant and the proppant down the well. That would be injected under pressure into this area here. It would fracture the shale, creating a network of artificially induced fractures within the shale, thereby improving the permeability and allowing the gas to flow out of the shale and into the well bore. The water would be returned to surface. The gas cannot get into the well bore while the water is in there, so all extra water would be removed out. It would be placed in a pit prior to be removed to recycling unit or a treatment plant. The gas, meanwhile, would, as I said, would come out of the formation into the well bore, not being pumped. It would go under lithostatic pressure. You can imagine this is buried to 7,000 feet in this case, and the pressure on this, on the gas within this rock, would be sufficient to force it up to the surface. It would flow out of the well, it would move to storage tanks, and from there would be transported to the consumer, whatever that might be. If we look at the advantages of... I was going to deal with the abandonment and completion of such a well, but these have been dealt with by Mr. Mills, so I won't spend any time on that. Again, I just want to briefly go through the benefits of shale gas. Gas shales are, by nature, very widely distributed. They're found throughout the world, often in places where conventional gas is not a viable economic option. This may allow countries without access to conventional resources to achieve energy independence or to change at least their energy mix and provide some sort of energy security. It does provide a cleaner energy source than coal. Carbon emissions are 50% lower. This is not specifically referring to South African coals per se. That is a research and statistical measure that coal, that gas, by means of its makeup, is has a lower carbon emission than coal due to its makeup. The question that related to South African coal and its demand globally and the fact that it does have higher carbon emissions. South Africa does export most of its high quality coal, and much of the coal that is used within our coal-fired power stations is lower quality coal, which has a high ash content as well as other toxins associated with it. Another question related to the reliability of shale gas. This was, I think, a problem of my delivery of this point. What we are saying here is that shale gas is reliable. It can also, gas power stations are reliable because they can be switched on and off very easily. They therefore provide a foundation fuel for the development of renewable sources of energy, which can be unreliable. It depends on the sun and it doesn't shine, your solar energy is under stress. So, but I think the important thing to look at are the issues and concerns. What I have tried to do here is look at global experience of these issues and concerns. We have not been exposed to them as a practical reality as yet, but it is important that we understand them in advance of the questions being raised. It is still a fossil fuel. It is still a fossil fuel. It has lower carbon emissions, but it is not a renewable resource. Environmental challenges, I've covered this in much detail last week. I just want to refer again to the global experience says that good well integrity will reduce groundwater contamination and can, to a large degree, preclude it. The surface footprint, this is a legitimate concern. Shale gas requires a large number of wells to be drilled. The global experience is that there is space to look for mitigation through multiple drilling and also by the placing of wells and drill pads in as optimally as possible. The number of wells that would be drilled would be dependent on, would be site specific and would be have to be dealt with in terms of EMPs and EIAs. This, as I showed last week, is the drilling of a horizontal well that was drilled underneath the runway at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. This is where shale gas has been fractured, and the integrity of the surface is still maintained well enough to land airplanes on it. Noise and traffic, another particular problem that could be arise. This has a limited time span. According to the literature, it's usually for a period of 2 to 3 months, after which a well can produce gas quietly for decades. Leads me to another question that was raised, which is how large is the resource? This is a question that is generally answered through the exploration process. It's only through that long process that Mr. Mills outlined that you can get a handle on how much gas is there. And this is also dependent on the economic climate at the time. The next issue is one I did not raise last time, and it refers to what is called NORM, which is naturally occurring radioactive material. Low levels of NORM is found in geological formations, particularly things like granites. So in the Paarl area, you might be aware that there have been records of radioactive anomalies. These can be brought to the surface through the process of drilling and producing oil and gas. However, my research at present shows that a report put out by the Groundwater Protection Council and the U.S. Department of Energy states that this usually remains in rock cuttings. It's usually in the solution. However, over time, it can be concentrated in fuel production equipment and sludges and slurries. It's usually very weak radiation. It doesn't penetrate steel casing. there's little risk for general public who don't come into contact with the equipment, and employers are obliged to enforce safety procedures under federal regulations in the states. The outline that Ms. Mekwe gave us highlighted the regulations that are in place to deal with waste disposal, both water and radioactive. The big issue is water use. This has been dealt with already this morning. I think that what we need to say here is that the Department of Water Affairs is directly involved in the assessment of any environmental management plan or environmental impact assessment. And the questions which would need to be answered is where will it come from, how will it be used, how will it be brought to the area, and how will it be disposed of. Globally, one of the means of mitigation is recycling of this water. We can use saline water. It could come from deep aquifers. It could even come from salt water. This, all these options would have to be investigated. Economic issues and concerns exist, and these relate to the profitability of the resource and also its lifespan. Profitability is dependent on the cost of producing, and these include the cost of ecological mitigation, obviously to produce responsibly costs money. It's important that producers are in a position to use technology that is expensive to produce as responsibly as possible. We talked about this being these resources happening in areas that are not available for conventional. Therefore, they're often stranded gas, and infrastructural development is often in its infancy and not developed and can be a cost, a front-end cost. And the price of gas plays an important role as well. This is, finally, I'd just like to briefly go through this little review. It's interesting to know that the first producing shale gas well was completed in Fredonia, New York in 1821. By the 1920s, there was the first field-scale development of shale gas in Ohio. By 1930s, there was a moderate development from the Antrim Shale in Michigan, which is still being developed today, about 80 years later. Development during this period was hampered by the difficulties of extraction from low permeability shales. But in the 80s and 90s, rapid development when the first large-scale hydraulic fracturing was used in the Barnett Shale in 1986, and the first horizontal well was applied to the development of shale gas in the Barnett in 1992. An interesting statistic is that half of the gas used today in the United States comes from wells drilled in the last 3.5 years. Where is shale gas found? In the United States, this is an outlay, a layout of, in pink and red, the areas of shale gas, the known shale gas basins. It has a significant impact. This still doesn't show. It's 1,800 TCF gas initially in place. That's a significant and very large number, and it has had a dramatic effect on the United States, changing its energy mix. It's reduced its reliance on imported liquefied natural gas, and it's de-linked the gas price from the oil price. In response to the question raised last year, this is because the gas price, the oil price, the volatility of the oil price negatively affected the development of the gas fields. What we can say nowadays is the gas price is something like a built-in regulator. It has a self-regulatory effect on the industry. The more successful it is, the lower the gas price, and therefore the less new development that takes place. The price of gas currently is in the United States is 3 to 5 million BTU, as opposed to the cost of producing gas at the moment is 6 to 8 BTU. So you can see only those companies that are operating at the very profitable margin of their development are managing to survive at that gas price. Currently, the world shale gas exploration in 2008, as I mentioned before, it's across the globe with concentration in the United States and Europe, but with also with developments in China, Russia, Poland, Romania, India, Australia. And in 2010, the focus has moved through to South Africa. But the United States is the only place which has put this to a significant test. The rest of the world, this industry is in its infancy. I think that this is the situation in South Africa. There are coordinated efforts by South Africans, coordinated South African efforts to establish contacts with experts within the United States to develop our competency. And we need to learn from them what they got right, but more importantly, what they got wrong, so that we don't ever be in the position that we make the same mistakes that were made before. I think it's important to stress that whatever the outcome or the future of the shale gas industry in South Africa, it is our duty to research and to understand the nature of this resource, using all the means at our disposal in order that we might be empowered and in a position to make the best decisions when they're brought before us. Thank you, Honourable Chairs. Thank you, Honourable Members. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope that this recap has answered the questions adequately that you raised last week.
Honourable Chairperson, just to close off Ms. Marek's presentation, I just want to emphasize again that what we are presenting is the outcome of our own research. We have to do the research so that by the time the applicants bring their plans to us, we are informed. So what we present here is not to say this is exactly what will happen in these areas of application. I'm responding to the question that says we seem to have already have preference for this method and so on. This is in preparation for the applications and for their plans, for us to have a baseline understanding of the methods that are to be used. So we will still wait for them to apply and assess them in terms of the knowledge that we have gathered. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All three presentations, I think, were sufficiently simplified. This is a highly technical field, but I think today you have managed to educate us. We can follow it easier, even though it's a highly technical field that you are operating in. Honorable members, there you are. It's not the new presentation, but I think it's more clarified presentation. Honorable Machibela, Honorable Kankumbus, Mutau, yes, sorry. Honorable Schmidt, that would be it for now. Honorable Sondo, is your hand up? All right, we'll take that. Okay, those four heads, in that order, please. Over to you, Honorable Machibela.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I see the slide, the unconventional gas play. There's this coal bed methane where you go down there at for gas. Is it going through coal there? Do you get me? Thank you. And the last one is about the clean and potential cheap electricity. I would like to argue my point with the word cheap electricity in South Africa. I don't know whether you are gauging your prices with the American dollar. Because if you are in America or wherever where they use a dollar, you find that it's $4 something. You go back and say, oh, it's $4 something. But are paying a lot of money. So I wonder, are you saying it's cheap because it's South African money? It's cheap, yes, for the Americans, but not for South Africans. There I would like to argue very strongly about that. We have to remove this word cheap electricity in South Africa, because it really makes people to fight out today. Even myself, when I get my bill, I never pay less than a 1,000-something electricity bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mtau.
Thank you, Chair. First, a question and then a comment. In the fracking process, where we have to use this loads and loads of water, is that an additive? I got the impression that sometimes something is added, some substance or lubricant is added to the water. If so, what is added? If nothing, that's fine. I just, as the presenters were talking, I got the impression that there might be some additive into the water. I just wanted to know what it is. But of course, the big problem is really the water, and especially if you look at the Karoo. We are gas-starved country. We need the gas. I think the case for gas has been made, especially looking at it from the energy perspective. We would like to find as much gas as we can to make it affordable. But to get it, especially if it's in the Karoo, where we don't have water, we're going to have to find the water from somewhere. And my view would be that for the licensing to happen for any one of those applicants, they've got to be able to satisfy the ministry that they would be able to find the water without denying the consumer the water.
Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two issues. One is, how often is a particular well fracked? In other words, is a fracking mechanism, does it occur once and then the gas then flows naturally to the surface? Or is that same well, that same hole, if I may call it, for lack of a better word, a horizontal well, fracked more than once? In other words, get the maximum to optimize the gas. Then another issue, that you seem to indicate that it could have a wide-ranging effect on the energy mix of South Africa. Now, there is something like the independent, the integrated energy plan, and there's fancy words, all these programs and plans. But my question is and I suppose shale gas is not included in that energy mix at the moment. Do you think it has the potential to have an impact on the IEP, with the knowledge you have at the moment, and should it be approved? Thank you.
Chairperson, I said, I'm just looking at the concerns, environmental, and the natural occurring radioactive material that this process produces. Yes, it might not affect metals. But what about us? What about human being and livestock? If sometimes it gets to the surface, you know, when you talk about radioactive material, you talk serious stuff. When it relates to humans, can we just get clarity on that one?
Thank you, Honorable Kululu.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm not sure whether this question has been answered, but it's on the economic side on shale gas regarding the pipelines. You mentioned that there is a lack of pipeline. Transportation of shale gas. My question would be that Transnet would be building a pipeline which would be transporting fuel importing multi-fuel commodities, such as fuel, gas, and all that, whether it's possible for you to also use that pipeline to transport gas. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must say this is quite a minefield, but obviously we have to grapple with it. Also, I'm quite thankful that there's been a rehash of the various areas around shale gas in particular, but obviously not overlooking that PASA has got other areas to look into as well. But my question, Chair, is that would it be possible for PASA to do some generic cost comparison for us? You see, when reference is made that mitigation is possible but expensive, you know, so once on the other side, the excitement is that here is an opportunity of, you know, energy, cleaner energy. But also there's curiosity as to what extent would this cleaner energy, you know, be accessible, but particularly be affordable. That's my little motivation, you know. But obviously it's not what one is saying that the PASA should give us now, if they can help us. But also I'm cautious that there's bidding around the corner. So if it's difficult, you know, one will understand, but still, should there be any possibility just to say what's the unit cost, you know, in shale gas, conventional gas, and other forms of energy? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just a few areas so that you answer us all and then we'll close the session. You've made mention of possibility of radiation, radioactive situation occurring during the process of fracking. But what concerns me most is whether there are any possibilities of a combustion occurring in the process of production, in which case a blast would, you know, cause some form of disaster, both to people who are working in there and also communities within the surrounding. That's one area. And linked to that is, in your research, what occupational diseases that are caused in the process of the production of this resource? Whilst we have not in the country moved quite far down the line, but indeed, you're tracing the history back from 1821, there must be empirical evidence in terms of even occupational diseases that are prevalent in the production of this resource. The other matter is the rehabilitation. You didn't spend some time in further explaining. Of course, one would understand that within the legal framework, it is expected that anyone who will get a license, you know, must also showcase in terms of resources that are required for rehabilitation, because we would be disturbing the environment, and therefore, logically, it would follow that there must be rehabilitation of that environment. But lastly, you know, so that we don't repeat the situation in the mining industry, where our minerals have been exploited for quite a number of years, centuries to be specific, without the benefit flowing directly to the citizens of the country. The constitution of this country as it stands enjoins us all to put our natural resources into ecological use and for the benefit of the people as a whole, because it's our national heritage. And what kind of mechanisms are you looking at building in terms of this new discovery of a resource, wherein, whilst issuing licenses, you'll be looking at how best would the country benefit out of it, except for consumption, because of course when we consume this gas, we'll have to pay. But of course, it's our natural resource. And then secondly, are you able to quantify? You know, I don't know. I know that at this stage it might be difficult because you must still explore to can be able to measure the value of the resource. But what are the preliminary, assumptions in terms of what kind of quantity of jobs that could be created in this process? Because the area you are looking at is quite vast, and it basically cuts across three provinces, if I'm not mistaken, Western Cape, Northern Cape, and what is this other province? Would it be, fine. Those are the areas that it basically would affect. Now, are there any possibilities of substantial jobs that could be created to also deal with the issue of the poverty alleviation? But most importantly for me, as I've made an example about mining, because mining has taken place and it has left the country behind in terms of benefits. Now this new resource, we need to guard against that, you know, repetition of the situation where only the investors will be able to realize or yield the returns out of, you know, this operations, and the people in the country will be left with a degraded kind of an environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I will address the first question about the unconventional resource and whether it's drilled through coal. The resource, yes, it is. The gas itself is actually stored in the coal. So what happens is, in fact, you might have heard of it as mine methane or coal mine gas. So as you mine the coal, the gas that's released is methane, and it causes a problem in mining for coal. So in coal bed methane, it's thought that it can be a win-win situation. You can remove the gas from the coal, and then you can mine it, because you can remove the gas without destroying the coal. But you do have to improve the permeability, and this does sometimes require fracking. But it is a coal resource. And in terms of the cheap electricity, I don't think that I was using it as a phrase about whether our electricity is cheap. I think it was the hope that a new source of gas could assist in maintaining a cheaper level of electricity. I think that was the question. The next question was about the lubricants, what is added to the fracking water. It is a mix. It consists of 99.5% water plus proppant. And the proppant can be sand or it can be artificial sand or something, an inert substance that is used to keep the fractures open once the liquid has been forced, once the fractures have been created. The remaining 0.49%, I think it is made up of a series of chemical ingredients. And those chemicals are related to things like to improve the lubrication, to stop flocculation. So many of the things they do, and often you might have heard people refer to things like their household products, because many of the tasks that they're aimed to do
are tasks that we look at in the domestic situation. So people have said things like swimming pool acid. So it's the same. So in order to keep the pH of the fluid right, they add an acid. It's the same acid that's used in swimming pools. There is detergents are added, such as you use for washing your dishes. If you wish to find out what the chemical ingredients are, and I don't have the slide, I had it last week and I don't have the slide with me this week. If you look on a web page called energyindepth.com, and it's all one word, energyindepth.com, they have a list of all the ingredients that are added to the fracking fluid and their relative percentages. I think rather than my trying to deal with that. Okay. The next question that I would like to answer is the one that deals with radioactivity. I think it was asked twice, and I would like to just clarify here. All shales, as you walk across the ground, the shale that you're walking on has a radioactive component. It's potassium, thorium, and very small percentages. It's very, very low. The amount of radioactivity you pick up in your house from your the various things you use in there is higher than the radioactivity you pick up from geological formations such as shales. As I mentioned before, there are things like granite which have small amounts of uranium associated with them or thorium, and these can be slightly higher. Shale gas, shales have a higher radioactivity than sandstone, but it's measured in micro amounts. A Geiger counter wouldn't pick it up as you walked past it. So it's not like when you talk radioactivity, you're not talking uranium or something like that. You're talking just about higher a concentration of potassium or thorium. And the concern was that over a very extended period, you would be drawing this stuff through the same equipment all the time, and there is a possibility that it could get concentrated. So those levels are regulated, and they are checked for with a Geiger counter. So if something like that happened, it would be cleaned and disposed of under the regulatory environment. I think does that answer your question? It is not considered as an environmental risk as such. I also have, on that same website, Energy in Depth, there is the reference that I got was from a thing called the shale gas primer, and there is an article there on norms and its effect on people and how it is mitigated and regulated in the United States. So we haven't been exposed to it yet.
I was wondering why you put it under environmental concerns.
I put it.
It has nothing to do. It has no negative impact on environment.
I used it as a response to a question that was raised last week about whether radioactivity was a concern. And I think that if you drilled through a radioactive level in order to get to your shale gas, it might be an environmental issue. In South Africa, we have not been exposed to it. We look at it as a potential issue. We don't believe that it is a critical issue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Before I give to Steve Mills on the fracking process and to Ms. Tunziki Van Averbeke on the energy mix, I just want to acknowledge Mr. Mutau's comment that water is going to be a big problem and that the applicants must satisfy the ministry and ourselves about the availability and the availability of water in this process. We've noted that it's going to be a big issue in our assessment of the environmental management program. Thank you. Steve.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I will attempt to address Advocate Smith's inquiry about the repeated fracking. The recent development which has practically enabled shale gas exploration is the ability to fracture several different points in a horizontal section consecutively I'm not aware that the technology has yet been developed to go back into such a well and refracture it at some later date in 6 or 10 or 12 years' time. So, but that's not impossible that the technology will be developed. I'm not sure that there's anything else I can add at this stage.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to address the question of the energy mix IEP. Yes, we have been contacted by the Department of Energy, and we were required to explain what kind of resources that we could expect from North Petroleum so that they can include all of that in the IEP. Because we did give them an explanation of the resources, conventional resources that we expect, because we do have estimates of those, seeing that we've got a lot of exploration offshore. We also gave them a guesstimate of the resources that we could, the unconventional resources that we could get onshore, and they promised that they would include all these, you know, provisional resources in the IEP. But then, of course, it's going to be a bit difficult because we do not have exact quantities, and the quantities would require more exploration. But they are aware of the other resources that could be available. And to address then the question from the chair, Mr. Njegelan, about whether we can prepare a report with a comparison of emissions that you get from coal or from gas, and also the economics of the two. Yes, such a report can be prepared, but I would beg the Honorable Chair that it is going to take some time because we do have other priorities, but it can definitely be done. Thank you, sir.
Before I give to Ms. Megwe on the occupational diseases, rehabilitation, and benefits to the people, I just want to comment on the pipelines. I think the pipelines and pipeline infrastructure will really be guided and depend on where the resource is found, because we're looking at huge areas, and the applicants must still determine where the areas of concentration are to be. So it's difficult for us at this stage to comment about which pipelines can be used or whether new infrastructure has to be put in place.
In response to Honorable Chair's concern in relation to occupational disease that are caused by this kind of operation, at the present moment, we don't have any detailed information to the occupational disease that can occur as a result of this kind of operation. However, it's something that we might touch base with the Office of the Chief Inspector of Mines to help us in relation to getting the knowledge in terms of any occupational disease that may be caused by this kind of operation. In relation to the rehabilitation program that are in place to remedy environment, yes, in terms of the content of the EMPR, the environmental management program that has to be submitted by the application to ensure that whatever environmental hazard or occurrence that may cause by this kind of operation, we will expect from them to give us an indication of the mitigating factors that they will ensure to make sure that they have rehabilitated those particular environment. And then over and above that, what we normally require from the applicant is that we require the financial provision as an insurance for us to make sure that should they not comply with commitment that they have made in relation to rehabilitating the environment, we will make it a point that we use that the financial provision to minimize or mitigate those environmental liabilities so that the liabilities are not transferred to the state and also to the people surrounding the area.
Just to close up, Chairperson, the Chairperson, Honorable Gono, also asked about advantages and other benefits beyond consumption that we can expect from the applicants. Chairperson, certainly the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act enjoins us to ensure that there are concrete social and labor plans that are put in place for the benefit of the people beyond the product that is to be made available. We also engage the applicants in skills development for both, you know, people within the organization. Our interns, we get them to go on site, both in the country and outside of the country, and gain as much knowledge as possible. We will also be looking at the training of the local people and the utilization of local resources as much as possible in the conduct of these processes. Thank you, Chairperson. We are at this stage not able to make estimates of the or assumptions with respect to the availability and potential job availability within these areas. It's still a bit of early stage for us, but we will be looking at that as developments go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have exhausted the discussions on the annual report of PASA. They have, in my view, answered all questions that we have raised adequately. And we must thank you very much for setting time aside for both days, coming through and engaging with us as the joint portfolio committees. And we hope that in the future, when you submit your report, your annual report through CEF, you will also make the special efforts that you also submit to us as portfolio committee so that you are able to engage in this kind of exercise. But of course, as you are handling matters of public interest, we may invite you back here at some stage when your processes on shale gas, you know, begin to take a clearer shape and to further engage with yourselves. But you have satisfied us for now in the past 2 days in terms of the presentations and the questions that we've asked. Honorable members, I'm putting it to you that this is clearer and I think it meets our requirements. Can I get a mover to adopt the report if you so wish? Honorable Matibela.
Thank you, Chairperson. I move for the adoption of the report.
Thank you very much. Any seconder? Honorable Bigani.
I second the adoption of the report, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any objections to the report being adopted? None. Thank you very much. Mine Health and Safety Inspectorate, please get ready. But we've been sitting here for quite some time, all of us. I don't know whether T has finally arrived. Not. Let's take a body break because we can't subject ourselves to this torture. Thank you.
So how did your meeting go? Was it there? Who was it? Was the minister there? Oh, okay. And grandpa there as well. Oh, okay. But all NSA members were there.
Continue with this. He's giving us 1 week to respond to make to keep.